So now let's give our attention to our brother Roger Lewis, and his title is Andrew, Giving Our Gift to God. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good evening, my dear brothers and sisters and young people. This evening, why, surprise, surprise, another character study. Why not? There's plenty of them to look at, but I think this particular one has got a wonderful story with a wonderful lesson, a wonderful exhortation that we can apply to ourselves under this title, Andrew, Giving Our Gift to God. You might remember there's a passage in the book of Peter that says, as every man hath received a gift, even so minister the same to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. And tonight's study is about a man who found his gift, who learned how to use it in ministering to others, and in the process, he multiplied its blessing as an offering back to God who'd given it to him in the first place. If you come to Matthew chapter 10, we've got the record in Matthew's account of the pairing up of the apostles as the Lord had first intended. Matthew chapter 10 says this in verse 2 when saying, now the names of the 12 apostles are these. And I want you to read just the second verse to notice how the wording is. It says, the first Simon who was called Peter and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee and John his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the publican, James the son of Alphaeus and Lebbaeus, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. Now, they're not inspired, brothers and sisters, but did you notice the semicolons? It says, you see, the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, semicolon. James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, semicolon. Philip and Bartholomew, semicolon. And I think that what we're being told here is since the Lord had sent these out two by two, as Mark 6 verse 7 tells us, it's clear that Andrew was originally paired with Peter his brother. But at some point, that pairing was altered. And by the end of Christ's ministry, Andrew was more closely linked to Philip. And this for reasons by and by that we shall discover. And I might just add in that context that when we speak of being paired with Philip, it's not the Philip who's one of the seven that we have in mind tonight, but the Philip who's of the 12, you see. In fact, if you come to the end of the story, always good to see the end of the story and then flip back to the start of the opening chapter again. But in Acts chapter 1, we do in a sense have the end of the story, because when it comes to the gathering of the disciples in the upper room, that first century ecclesia established now in Jerusalem after the ascension of our Lord, it says this in Acts chapter 1 verse 13. When they were come in, they went up into an upper room where abode both Peter and James and John and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus and Simon Zelotes and Judas the brother of James. And so Andrew's name will now appear after Peter and James and John, but alongside Philip. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that these two ended up as the best of friends. And I think that in itself tells us something, probably, about Andrew's own nature. You see, Philip was extremely shy. Philip was of a retiring disposition, but he worked well with Andrew, and Andrew with him. There was something in the character of Andrew that drew others out of themselves. And he was presumably of a quieter, more restrained nature himself, which is possibly why Philip felt comfortable both with him and encouraged by him. And how that all happened, since remember that's the end of the story, well, we better come back to the start again and find how that journey took place. How that all happened is the story for our study this evening. Well, Mark chapter 1 tells us, I think, where the study should begin, because Mark 1 records a certain moment, you might remember, on a certain shore, on a certain sea, the Sea of Galilee, and this remarkable event occurs in Mark 1, verse 16. We had the equivalent of that in our reading from Matthew in our readings groups this afternoon. Mark 1 verse 16 says, "Now as the Lord walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew his brother casting a net into the sea, for they were fishers." So you see, Andrew worked with Peter in their family fishing business. They didn't just work together, they lived together. We know that from verse 29 of this same chapter. They entered into the house of Simon and Andrew. So these two brothers both worked together and lived in the same house. These two brothers grew up together, as unsurprisingly they might have. And Mark 1 verse 17 says, "Jesus said unto them, Come ye after me, and I will make you fishers of men." So the call to become fishers of men was first made to Peter and Andrew. But surprisingly, in certain respects, it would turn out that Andrew might well have been more successful in this work because he possessed a special skill for its accomplishment. And it's that skill, that talent, that gift that we want to discover in Andrew's story tonight and how he gave it back to his God. So verse 18 says, remarkable really, isn't it? And straightway they forsook their nets and followed him. And straightway, you'll probably know, euthios is Mark's most famous word. It's the word of dynamic and immediate action. Straightway they forsook their nets. Seems remarkable, doesn't it, that Christ could turn up so unexpectedly on the shores of a lake, call these two fishermen to service, and have them leave their boat and nets behind immediately. Remarkable. But it wasn't quite so unexpected as it seemed, was it? Because they already knew this voice. They'd already met this man. Long before he walked on the shore and called them in Mark 1, there'd already been an encounter between Andrew and Christ. And that encounter takes us back to John 1 and to the reading that we introduced our study with tonight. So in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, this is an event that happens before Mark, chapter 1. And the record says, in maybe verse 35 for connection, where we began tonight, "Again the next day after John stood and two of his disciples, and looking upon Jesus as he walked, he saith, Behold the Lamb of God. And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus." And they... Jesus turned, says verse 38, "and saw them following, and saith unto them, What seek ye? And they say unto him, Rabbi, which is to say, being interpreted, Master, where dwellest thou?" Now, of course, we realize, brothers and sisters, that their question wasn't really about the place where Jesus dwelt. They didn't really want to know where you're living. It was really a way of saying that they wanted to spend some time with him in conversation in the future. He was a teacher. They sought to be his disciples. Master, Rabbi, where dwellest thou? It was a permission. They were asking permission to sit at his feet and to learn his teaching. And so Jesus said, verse 39, "Come and see." And they came and saw where he dwelt and abode with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. And so the answer of Jesus was to tell them that the time for conversation was right now. So they ended up spending most of the day with him. And that one conversation, brothers and sisters, was all that Andrew needed to be convinced that this man was the Messiah of Old Testament. Andrew was utterly convinced. Now, we know that one of them was Andrew because the next verse tells us, you see. Because verse 40 says, one of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. So he's definitely one of the two. Right at the start, he's going to hear the Lord. But did you notice that interesting expression? One was Andrew, the Simon Peter's brother. Do you know, out of the 13 times that Andrew is mentioned, that phrase is used 6 times. It confirms the idea that Andrew wasn't a dominant personality. Can you imagine in the meeting of those days, you know, oh, there's Andrew over there. Who? Andrew. Who's that? Who's Andrew? Andrew, you know, Simon Peter's brother. Oh, Simon Peter's brother. Now everyone knew who Andrew was, but on his own, he wasn't well known, you see. It was his relationship with Peter that people recognized him by. Not everyone knew who Andrew was, but everyone knew who Peter was. So he became Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. It became a way to identify Andrew, but of course, in that process, it made him the lesser of the two. He was always the second to a more recognized brother. But quieter though he may have been, he had a gift, he had a talent that he would use with wonderful effect in the service of the truth. And what that gift was now to be revealed. So verse 41 says, he first findeth his own brother Simon, and saith unto him, we have found the Messiah, which is being interpreted, the Christ. Now you see that word first, protos in the Greek. It means first in time or place, foremost in rank or dignity. And I think that that word is, as it were, the index to Andrew's entire character. It's the mark of his special gift. Now, you realize, of course, that we could use that word or read that word protos in several different ways. It could mean, when it says he first findeth his own brother and saith unto him, it could mean that that was the first thing he did. Or it could mean that it was the first of all the people he brought. Or it could mean, as I think it does, on this occasion, that he found his own brother first. Because remember, there's two disciples who meet the Lord, and they both go off to find their respective brothers. Now, who's writing this story, brothers and sisters? Well, John is writing this gospel. And although two men went off to search for their respective brothers, John, who's writing the gospel and who we believe was the other one of the two who followed Jesus, he graciously affords to Andrew the primacy in this matter. Andrew got to his brother and back to Jesus first. He beat John. John writes it that way in his gospel. He says, well, actually, John was the first. Andrew was the first, you see. He came back with his brother before I did. Young's literal says, this one doth first find his own brother, Simon. So you see, Andrew was the protos, the first in this particular matter. He was the first of all the disciples to follow Jesus, verse 37. And now he will be the first of all the disciples to bring someone to Jesus. Verse 42. He was the protos. And that rank would never be taken from him, but it was more than just a mark of honor for his beginning. He was first in this regard, not just because of the special gift he had, but because he exercised that gift in the truth's service. And so verse 42 says, he brought him to Jesus. And when Jesus beheld him, he said, thou art Simon, the son of Jonah. Thou shalt be called Cephas, which is by interpretation a stone. So when Andrew introduced Peter to Christ, he knew that he would be relegated in importance, don't you think? He just knew it because he worked on the same boat with Peter for years. He would be the second. But so convinced was he about the messiahship of Christ that he didn't hesitate. He brought his brother to Christ. There was something great about that spirit, you see. Andrew wasn't interested in prominence. He was interested in doing what was best for the truth, and he would be a loyal servant to that cause. And all this happened in this gospel record, brothers and sisters, 6 months before Mark chapter 1 and the visit on the beach. That's why they left so hastily off the shore, because this man's message had been churning in their minds for the last 6 months. Do you know, Christ once said in Mark 5 and verse 19, he said, "Go home to thy friends and tell them how great things the Lord hath done." And Andrew was one who fulfilled that scripture of his own free will. And then verse 43 of John 1 says, the day following, Jesus would go forth into Galilee, but before he did, before he went, he findeth Philip and saith unto him, "Follow me." So you see, if Andrew was quiet, Philip was even more so. Andrew found Christ, verse 41, but Christ needed to find Philip. And he found him down in the south of the land where John Baptist was preaching. In fact, hiding in the story somewhere around this moment of time is an interesting connection with the book of Joshua, of which things we ought now not to speak particularly. So the verse says, verse 44, now Philip was of Bethsaida, and that one visit that he had with the Lord was just the same as the one visit that Andrew had with the Lord. And for both of these men, one visit with the Lord was enough to change their lives. But do you notice what the record says here in verse 44 about Philip? It provides an interesting detail about Andrew, because it mentions that he came from and lived in Bethsaida. Now, Bethsaida was on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. So says Mark 6, verses 45 and 53. In fact, the word meant fish town, which is probably why they were there, because it was a fishing settlement on the shores of the lake itself. That's where the Lord had found Andrew with Peter, his brother, in Mark 1. But you see, what this verse tells us, good Bible study, remember, is based on good Bible reading, is that this was both Philip's and Andrew's hometown. They both came from Bethsaida. These two men knew each other already. They would be even more closely bound together in the truth's work as Christ called them to his band of followers. So the record says, it tells us these things. And as we start to enter the story of what Andrew will accomplish, that connection, not just with Philip, but with the city of Bethsaida, will become perhaps significant in the story. Well, that brings us to Mark chapter 6, because Mark 6 now records another episode where Andrew will be involved. And it's, again, highly relevant to the understanding of Philip's gift and of Andrew's gift, and his appropriate use of it in the service of the truth. So Mark 6 says, reading from verse 35, when the day was now far spent, the Lord's disciples came unto him and said, "This is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away that they may go into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat." You know, it is all how you read it, brothers and sisters, and I can't be certain, but do you sense a slight hint of impatience with the disciples in these words? You see, I think they thought the Lord was a wonderful teacher, but they did not know about his ability to deal with the practical needs of his followers. I think that they thought that he was unaware of the predicament that they had found themselves in, and you can almost sense that in the language. They came to him and said, in case you didn't notice, Lord, this is a desert place. It is after dinner time. You better send them away to find something, because in case you didn't notice, they've got nothing to eat. Just a little touch, don't you think? Because these men were as yet unaware of the greatness of him with whom they had to do. And the Lord said, oh, wonderful what the Lord said, verse 37. The Lord answered and said unto them, no, you give ye them to eat. So Jesus turned their suggestion on its head. Do you notice? Not send them away to buy, but give ye them to eat. So the Lord absolutely confronted them with the dilemma of the situation and said, no, you solve it. And the disciples were going to learn that he who could provide the bread of life was also perfectly capable of providing a meal of daily bread as well. The dimensions of the problem were well beyond their ability to solve, but not beyond his. Actually, when it says, verse 37, 200 pennyworth of bread, well, you probably know that at a penny a day, that was probably about a year's worth of a man's wages. Well, the disciples just didn't have that sort of money in the purse. They said, we can't solve this problem, it's too immense. So the Lord said this, verse 38. He said, how many loaves have ye? Go and see. And when they knew, they say, 5 and 2 fishes. And he commanded them to make all sit down by companies upon the green grass, and they sat down in ranks by hundreds and by fifties. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, he looked up to heaven and blessed and brake the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the 2 fishes divided he among them all. Do you know, I think there's a reason in verse 38 why the Lord asked them specifically how many loaves they had. Why didn't the Lord just say, how much food have you got? Why did he ask, how many loaves have you got? Well, I think you see that the Lord had in mind an Old Testament story. You might know it, but come and have a look in the 2nd of Kings chapter 4, because it's a remarkable connection. In the 2nd of Kings chapter 4, in the time in the life of Elisha, there was just such a moment as they were to experience now. And the same dilemma was confronted and dealt with by the man of God. Because we're told this in 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 42 to 44, these words. See if you can hear Mark chapter 6 in this story. There came a man from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley and full ears of corn and the husk thereof. And he said, Elisha said, give unto the people that they may eat. And his servitor said, what, should I set this before 100 men? And he said again, no, you give the people that they may eat. For thus saith Yahweh, they shall eat and shall leave thereof. So he set it before them, and they did eat and left thereof according to the word of Yahweh. And so Elisha's minister learned a powerful lesson that day about how a few barley loaves in the hands of the man of God could feed a multitude and still leave a surplus. Isn't that Mark 6? How many loaves have ye, says Christ? Oh, that was an interesting question. It took their minds back to this Old Testament episode. And why that's interesting is because that story in Mark 6 didn't quite happen as Mark says. Because although Mark 6 says, give ye them to eat, and they say unto him, shall we buy 200 pennyworth? And he said unto them, how many loaves, go and see. And when they knew, they say, fire. That's not actually what happened, brothers and sisters. Not quite. Only one disciple talked about needing 200 pennyworth of bread. And only one disciple found out how much they did have, and how that could possibly be set before such a multitude, just like Elisha's servant had done. Well, those two men are mentioned in John's account of the story. Because in John 6, and this is one of the benefits, isn't it, of reading and being enriched by comparing the gospel records, differing as they might because of different purposes of the gospels, the four faces of the cherubim. But this is John's account of the same story. John 6, verse 5 says, "When Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he said unto Philip, Whence shall we buy bread that these may eat?" And I suggest that this question to Philip in John 6, verse 5, probably came after Christ had already said to his disciples, "Give ye them to eat." And when they were unable to provide an answer, he then turns to Philip. He says, "Now, Philip, what would you do? Where would you get it from?" And as the verse goes on to say in verses 6 and 7, "And this he said to prove him," Philip, "for he himself, the Lord, knew what he would do. And Philip said, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little." So Philip was to learn the power of the one who was the manifestation of his Father. But Christ singled out Philip with this question. Why? Well, one of the reasons why was because Luke's account, which we shan't turn up, Luke's account in Luke 9 verse 10 says, "And he took them and they went aside privately into a desert place belonging to the city called Bethsaida." So the wilderness they were in at this moment, the desert place, was close by the city of Bethsaida, but that's Philip's hometown. "Philip, you live here," says the Lord. "You live around these parts. Where shall we go to get this food?" And it was Philip who made the comment that even 200 pennyworth wouldn't be enough. And I think that was the moment when the Lord must have asked, "How many loaves have you? Go and see." And now we see the significance of what follows in John's record. Because you see, I think that Andrew saw his friend's dilemma, Philip's dilemma. And Andrew, don't forget, came from the same area. He could see Philip struggling with the dimensions of the problem. He wanted to help his friend, relieve him of that burden. So off went Andrew into the crowd, as no doubt the other 11 disciples or apostles did. And John 6 says this, verse 8. One of his disciples, Andrew, who? Simon Peter's brother, saith unto him, "There's a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many?" Now think about it, brothers and sisters. There were thousands and thousands of people there that day, and all 12 disciples went out into the multitude to search. But only one disciple came back with an answer. And his name was Andrew. And notice the answer. "There is a lad here." Now, that word "lad" in the Greek is padarion, a little boy. So you see, can imagine this little boy, just a little whippersnapper. He's there in this desert place listening to the words of Jesus. Perhaps he was from Bethsaida, out with his lunchbox, gone to hear the talk. So this little boy looks up at all these big men scouring the multitude for the possibilities of nourishment. And I think he decided that Andrew looked the friendliest. You see, to be friendly is to be approachable. So this little boy comes up to Andrew, "Please, sir, I've got some food." So Andrew knelt down. "Well done. What have you got, my boy?" "I've got 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Would that be enough?" "Oh," says Andrew, "that'd be a big help. Now you come along with me and we'll take it to Christ. Come along now, don't be afraid." Puts his hand on the boy's shoulder and he takes him to the Lord. Didn't take the food to the Lord, did you notice? He took the boy to the Lord with the food. I don't think that boy's life would ever be the same. He saw the Son of God turn his little lunchbox into a banquet for thousands. And I suggest that the evidence of that miracle done in his presence probably made him a disciple of the Lord afterwards, don't you think? What's the likelihood that in maturity he became a loyal follower of this teacher whom he met on that unforgettable day? And if he did become a disciple, then he had Andrew to thank, didn't he, for bringing him on that day to see the Lord? Or did you notice verse 9 that they were barley loaves? 2 Kings chapter 4. Well, that brings us to the next stage of our considerations, and it's to be found in John chapter 12. And there's a moment later on in the story of the Lord, John chapter 12, where Andrew will yet again appear in the record and to good intent and purpose. John 12 says, perhaps reading from verse 17, "The people, therefore, that was with him when he called Lazarus out of his grave and raised him from the dead, those who'd witnessed that miraculous resurrection by the Lord, they bear record." And so verse 18 says, "For this cause the people also met him, for that they had heard that he had done this miracle. And the Pharisees therefore said among themselves, 'Perceive ye how ye prevail nothing? Behold, the world is gone after him.'" Now that statement of the Pharisees was captured by John because of its prophetic significance. In the first instance, what they were really saying is that everyone was supporting or wanting to listen to the teaching of Jesus after the miraculous raising of Lazarus. But John records it because, you see, he saw that implicit in those Pharisaic words was the suggestion that the Gentile world would be affected by this man's work. "The world's gone after him," said the Pharisees. And as if to underscore the truth of that, verse 20 says, "And there were certain Greeks among them that came to worship at the feast." So the phrase, "Behold, the world has gone after him," verse 19, is immediately followed by, "And there were certain Greeks," verse 20. And now this time, the word Greeks is Hellen, which means Gentiles. These weren't Greek-speaking Jews. No, these were foreigners. These were Gentiles. They were proselytes of the gate. They probably came from the cities of Decapolis, which were the Greek-speaking cities in Israel in those times. Some of them might have already met Christ. He'd visited that region more than once, and they were fervent enough to be at the temple to worship at the feast. So these Greeks who'd come, realizing that Christ was there, verse 21 says, "The same came therefore to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, 'Sir, we would see Jesus.'" Now, they might have come to Philip because some of them might have known him. But in seeking a likely contact amongst the Lord's disciples, they might have chosen Philip to approach because he had a Greek name. He might have even had some Gentile ancestry. We certainly know that their tone was deeply respectful because they came to Philip and they addressed him as "Sir." Words kurios, Lord. "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." And of course, just as Andrew had with John asked the Lord in John chapter 1, "Where dwellest thou?" meaning really that we wanted to spend some time with Messiah. So these Greeks, they didn't want to see Jesus in the sense of looking at him. They wanted to spend some time with him. And their request wasn't just a matter of protocol. You see, they couldn't meet Christ because where the Lord was in the court of the woman, they were forbidden to come. The wall of partition marked the boundary of the court of the Gentiles, beyond which they could not come in approaching Jesus. So they called to Philip, "Sir, we would see Jesus." Now, he was a problem because there was no doubting their earnestness, but Gentiles? Gentiles to be involved? Hadn't Christ earlier said to his men, "Go not into the way of the Gentiles, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel," Matthew chapter 10, verse 5. So Philip wasn't sure what to do. So what did he do? He turned to his good friend Andrew. "Psst, come over here, quick. These Gentiles want to see Jesus. What do I do? Can you hear the conversation, brothers and sisters? He calls on his friend. And so the record says, verse 22, Philip cometh and telleth Andrew. And again, Andrew and Philip telleth Jesus. Now, just notice the words here and the order of the names, because I think the flow of the narrative is that Philip came and sought Andrew's help. Andrew made the decision that it was the right thing to present their request to Jesus. And I think that the record implies that Philip wanted Andrew to lead the conversation. Do you think they should come? I think they should come. Can you say it to the Lord? You do it. So Philip says to Andrew, you speak. So Andrew says, all right, I will. So they're both going to go, but you see, it's Andrew that steps in, again, to help out his friend. But it's Andrew who knows what to do. So Philip cometh and telleth Andrew, now becomes, and Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. I think Andrew led that conversation with Christ. And in making that petition and presenting that request, what he did was he set something wonderful in motion, because he brought the Gentiles to Christ. And I think there was something very significant in that decision, that Andrew's thinking was in advance of its time. Because when faced with the issue, his immediate response was, yes, I believe that the Gentiles have a place in the work of Christ. Now, even his big brother Andrew had problems with that, didn't he? Andrew struggled, because of his Jewish prejudice, to separate from the Gentiles in Antioch, says Galatians. And only a special revelation finally convinced Peter that the Gentiles were to be fellow heirs. But Andrew knew. Andrew was certain. Andrew could remember the words of Christ, Matthew 21, verse 13. It is written, my house shall be called the house of prayer. But Andrew knew where the Lord had quoted from. That was Isaiah 56. The sons of strangers will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. For mine house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. And hadn't the Lord only a little while earlier in John 10, before this exchange in John 12, said, and other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring. You see, I think that Andrew had a real spiritual insight into the wider purpose of God, and that purpose would reach out above and beyond the Jewish nation to touch Gentiles. There was great spiritual discernment of Andrew in that wider purpose. And wasn't Andrew there at the very first when John Baptist had declared, behold, John chapter 1, verse 29, behold the Lamb of God which taketh away the sin of the world. Andrew'd heard that. And verse 23 says, Jesus answered them, saying, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. And I think what the record is telling us in this verse is that whatever Christ said, it was in measure an answer to the petition of Andrew on behalf of the Gentiles. The Lord was responding to the request that Andrew had made. And one of the scriptures that Jesus was alluding to in verse 23 was this one in Isaiah 49, verses 3 and 6, when it says, he said unto me, thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified. And he said, it is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the ends of the earth. I think Andrew knew his scriptures, brothers and sisters, and I think that Christ endorsed Andrew's understanding and accepted this request of the Gentiles to learn of him and to share in the hope of Israel. Marvelous, marvelous things. Because now bring that together, brothers and sisters, this little story. Because embedded in these episodes is the key to Andrew's character. John 1, he brought Peter to Christ. John 6, he brought the lad to Christ. John 12, he brought the Gentiles to Christ. You see how easy it would have been for Andrew to have taken a different path. Peter, well, I won't mention that to my brother in case he takes over from me. The lad, don't bother me now, boy, I'm busy on something important. The Gentiles, Greeks wanting to talk with the Lord, I'm not sure I want to interrupt Christ with that request. How easy it would have been for Andrew to leave a legacy of turning people away from Christ. But instead, he had a reputation for bringing people to Christ. You see, the character of God is intrinsically positive. God is focused on receiving, on returning, on restoring. And Andrew knew that. You see, I think he'd found his work in the truth. He might not be a leader. He might not be a speaker. He might not be an administrator. But he was outstanding at personal conversation with others and excellent at bringing people to Christ. He was never going to be one of the Lord's inner circle. Like Benaiah among David's mighty men, he attained not unto the first three. But there was no resentment, no envy, no malice on Andrew's part. He didn't try to be someone that he wasn't. Andrew was giving quiet application to what he could do. He was focused on his service in the truth. And the crucial thing is, he'd found that work. He'd found his voice. You see, Andrew's work related to his gift, and he had the gift of friendliness. It is a gift, by the way, brothers and sisters. And not everyone has it. The gift of friendliness is the ability to reach out comfortably to others. The gift of friendliness is the spirit of kindliness which sets others at ease. The gift of friendliness is the skill of dialogue which allows others to talk. The gift of friendliness is the sense of warmth that helps others to respond. The gift of friendliness is the offer of relationship that draws others close. The gift of friendliness is the care of interest that permits others to grow. Isn't that a gift, brothers and sisters? But the question is, have we found our gift? What's our gift, the gift that God has blessed us with? And what gift is that that we might now use to his honor and in his service? Because you see, even if we've discovered it, we need to focus on how we can now use that in the best possible way. Now, take Andrew's gift as an illustration. If you felt that your gift of friendliness might be helpful for local preaching or missionary work, which it would be, but what else would you need to do to harness that gift properly and well? Being friendly isn't enough to preach the truth properly. What parts of Scripture do you really need to study for that role? What key Bible doctrines do you need to really understand? What Bible characters might inspire you to that work, and have you studied them to learn from the lessons of their life? What issues might there be in different cultures, and how will you reconcile them to the way of Christ? You see, it's one thing to say we found Messiah. It's quite another to be able to teach the fullness of Messiah's work that might lead someone into the waters of baptism. Turning the gift of friendliness into the work of bringing people to Christ demands spiritual commitment. And so the lesson, brothers and sisters, is that even a gift needs working on if it's to be given, really given to God in service. Life in the truth must be lived with purpose. And it begins with an honest assessment of our God-given abilities and how we might best use them. You know, I think we all need to go on the journey, you see, that Andrew went on. And what we've got to do is to recognize humbly but thankfully those talents that God has blessed us with, and then find how we might give them back to Him with thankful, earnest, diligent commitment and intent. The story of Andrew is the cameo of a disciple who knew his gift and learned to use it in the service of his Lord. As it says in one of our hymns, we give thee but thine own. Whate'er the gift may be, all that we have is thine alone, a trust, O Lord, from thee. May we thy bounties thus as stewards true receive, and gladly as thou blessest us, to thee our first fruits give.